Herzlich willkommen beim Podcast des Bundesinstituts für Bevölkerungsforschung. Mein Name ist Katja Patzwald. In vielen Ländern südlich der Sahara hat die Corona-Pandemie einen Einbruch in der wirtschaftlichen Entwicklung verursacht, ja, die Armut in vielen Regionen deutlich verschlimmert. Dabei sind Erwerbstätigkeit von Frauen, Bildung, Gesundheit und Familiensituation natürlich enorm wichtig für die sozioökonomische Entwicklung einer Bevölkerung sowie auch klarerweise für die individuelle Situation. In Nigeria, so befürchtet die Ökonomin Nkechi Owu, die heute dabei ist, wird das projizierte Bevölkerungswachstum die Ernährungskrise verschärfen. Nkechi Owu, Gesundheits- und Bevölkerungsökonomin an der Universität Ghana, ist außerdem Fellow in Pretoria und an der Cornell University. In ihrer Forschung hat sie sich mit Armut beschäftigt und auch mit Selbstbestimmung von Frauen, besonders mit Schwerpunkt auf Ghana und Nigeria. Dieser Teil des Gesprächs wird auf Englisch stattfinden.
The country with the largest population is Nigeria, with almost 200 million people living there. And you have conducted research on the nutrition situation in Nigeria. And you say that while already many people are undernourished and malnourished today, the situation might even worsen, and there the population figure comes to play a role. So could you please elaborate a little bit on this, why you think that is the case and how which parts of the population are affected as well?
So yes, the world's population we know is expected, you know, to hit the 8 billion mark by November, mid-November this year. And according to the UN, I think it's Department of Economic and Social Affairs, it says that, you know, when we think about this projected increase in the world's population up to about 2050, a lot of this increase is going to be found in 8 main countries. And out of those 8 countries, 5 of them are on the sub-Saharan African continent. Nigeria is one of those African countries. Now, as you already stated, currently it's the most populated country in Africa and also the 7th largest country in the world. And now there are some concerns about the well-being of individuals within this country. Well, because we know that according to the World Food Programme, for example, 60% of the population is poor. It's living below the country's poverty line. We also know that a similar proportion of people in the country are actually facing moderate to severe food insecurity. Now, when we think about some of the reasons why the country is, facing this food insecurity crisis, we can think about things like, you know, low productivity agriculture. There are also concerns about, you know, the armed conflicts in the northern parts of the country. And of course, the COVID-19 pandemic also came in to further, you know, worsen the existing situation. But there are other studies, including one that I conducted, that found that, you know, larger families, larger households tend to be more vulnerable to food insecurity. And this is just by virtue of the thinner distribution of food resources among members of the household. Now, we know that the country's population, that's Nigeria's population, is very large, but it's also very youthful. Right? It has a large youthful population. And what it means is that over time, this can translate, once these individuals get into their childbearing ages, translates to increases in population. Households would have to, you know, adopt to this situation by adopting coping strategies like, you know, reducing their food portions, eating meals less frequently. I mean, when we think about the country's food security situation, yes, I think that it's a good idea to think about the supply side. That is making sure that food production is maximized. Agricultural productivity, you know, includes a lot more technological innovations, all of that. But I think that what tends to be less focused on is the demand side, right? Reducing the number of, say, unwanted mistimed births, so that we can reduce household sizes and then see that, or perhaps increase, you know, the average food resources available to members within the household.
Yeah, I think we will come back to that as well. I've read that in Nigerian households on average, that they spend more than half of their income on food, which is quite a high share in international comparison. Mm-hmm. So do rural and urban households differ in that respect?
Yes, so as we know, food expenditures are one of the ways or one of the indicators of food insecurity in a given country. So when the average spending on food, for each household member is lower, it can be an indication that, there's food insecurity prevalent in that household, within communities, and so on. Now, I should mention that, the evidence for the differences in food insecurity between rural and urban Nigeria tends to be mixed. So some studies have found that there are no significant differences between these two geographical locations, but others, and I'll cite a recent paper by Bloom and others in 2021, I believe, they did find that food insecurity was higher in rural areas compared to urban areas, particularly around the COVID-19 pandemic. But I think that we should emphasize that in truth, both of these areas, rural versus urban areas, tend to be characterized by different shocks that affects food security. Because we see a lot of agricultural production happening in rural areas, production shocks, relating to, inadequate inputs, lack of availability of land, these are things that affect food security in rural Nigeria. But when we look at what happens in urban Nigeria, the shocks are of a different nature. These are relating to consumption, right? So things like price hikes, increases in the prices of foodstuffs, that is what impacts food insecurity in urban Nigeria. So it's important to keep in mind that the source of insecurity or, lack of access or availability of food differs between these two geographical locations. And when we appreciate the differences, well, then it becomes, easier to try to target particular solutions and interventions to these two different geographical areas within the same country.
Yeah, and at the same time, in rural areas, there are also many children who have to work on their family's farms because otherwise the production won't be sufficient to meet the basic needs. The ILO estimated that 1/3 of the 5 to 14 year olds work, and this takes place mostly in families and on farmland. Those estimates are, however, from the year 2017. So they refer only to the years before 17, and during that time it was even on the rise. So what is your stake on how that could be reduced or ended?
This is a big question, right? And it's a question that keeps on coming up. This issue of how do we go about ending child labor? It's a really complicated issue, not as straightforward as it seems. Okay, so I want to start off just for the benefit of your listeners, saying that when we think about, labor, not all labor that children are engaged in is child labor. And I like that you mentioned the ILO. So according to the ILO, in order for to qualify as child labor, it says that, the work has to be, mentally, physically, or socially dangerous, right, and harmful to children. It also has to, interfere with the ability to go to school, deprive them of the opportunity to attend school, or sometimes it can cause them to leave school prematurely. Oftentimes children are forced to try to combine, attending school with taking part in very long, excessive, heavy work, right? So child labor sometimes even can vary by country to depend on the child's age, right? So for some countries, children, when you hit 15, you are no longer a child. For others, it's 18, and so on and so forth. Even the type of work, the hours of work performed, the definitions can vary, for different countries. And so when I think about, when we child labor, I think that it's something that happens or is caused by different factors, but also happens or is important to keep in mind at different levels, right? It can be prevalent within at the household level, sub-national level, and also at the national level, these factors can be relevant for contributing to child labor. And there can also be a mix of, economic, social, and cultural issues that come together to lead to this situation of child labor. So I'm simply trying to give a sense of how complicated that can be. But I'll focus on one issue, one of the contributory factors to child labor. Let's talk about poverty, right? A lot of studies have shown that poverty is one of the prime reasons or prime factors that contributes to the practice of child labor. And so it's no surprise that even when you take individual countries, the practice tends to be more prevalent in rural areas, which generally have higher poverty levels. So I mentioned that it can also be observed, and I mean, there are different levels of explanation for why we see this. So let's take the household level. We can have situations where, parents or guardians or adults within the household simply are not making enough money, and therefore they need to supplement the household's income by having children engage in child labor. That's at the household level. But even at the community, district, at the sub-national level, sometimes poorer communities that don't have access to social infrastructure, say poor roads, it can be a detriment to children actually attending school. And therefore, when children cannot have access to these social resources, it tends to lead naturally to them being engaged in work that we can classify, given the specifications I talked about before, as child labor. You can even have factors at the national level, right? So we can have laws that don't necessarily mandate that children of school-going age be in school, right? And laws that don't ensure that this is what happens. So I'm saying that, it can be when we think about the issue of trying to tackle child labor, I believe that it has to be done from, a multi-level perspective. It cannot be one approach because, as you can see, the issues are prevalent at the household, community, even at the national level. We would have to address certain economic, structural, cultural, even legal challenges. But I think it is worth at least bringing it to the fore because, as we know, child labor has implications even for the health of children, their educational attainment. It's something that continues to be an issue, and I'm happy that at least it continues to be talked about, and hopefully we'll have more adequate solutions, long-lasting solutions to this issue of child labor.
Yeah, you've already mentioned earlier that government shouldn't just focus on increased food production to alleviate a malnutrition situation, but it would also help the food situation of each individual in a family if women were to have fewer children. However, only 1 of 10 married women in Nigeria uses modern contraceptives. So, what's the reason in your point of view that reliable contraceptives are not commonly used?
When I say that, women should, try to reduce their fertilities because I do believe it has implications. That's what the research found for a country's food security status. This is not to say that women shouldn't have the number of children that they want. I'm referring specifically to situations where women have, mistimed births or unwanted births. This is where I think that there's a role to be played in minimizing, these types of outcomes. Now, I think that in the Nigerian setting, there are quite a number of reasons why we see such a low uptake of contraceptives, both in Nigeria and indeed in many other sub-Saharan African settings, particularly, in the western part of the continent. And one of this has to do with male partners in general, right? In many cases, a woman uses these contraceptives when her male partner is in agreement with the use of this. And sometimes we see that male partners may not favor the use of contraceptives, right? One reason is that oftentimes they prefer to have a larger number of children. Now, historically, having a large number of children was a sign of, a man's virility, right? It showed that, he was in control of his own reproduction. He was virile, but also it was also a sign of the household's wealth status. If you have a lot of children, it symbolizes that, you are rich enough to take care of these children. Oftentimes, so that is one reason why men sometimes can be in favor of having more children and not using contraceptives. But then there's also this other reason that qualitative studies on the continent have picked up, that men oftentimes also disapprove of women using contraceptives because they think that it will make, their wives more promiscuous, right? If male partners are not in support, women oftentimes will not feel comfortable using these contraceptives. We have had situations where even when women visit the sexual and reproductive health clinics and their partners are not in agreement, it can lead to harmful repercussions for women themselves. It can lead to intimate partner violence. It can lead to men, even divorcing these women because they are doing something. They are taking control of, of the number of children within the household without the agreement of men. Another reason is that, women themselves, apart from, men not being in agreement with these reproductive health actions, other women themselves have said that they may not opt for contraceptives, one, for religious reasons, right? In the country, in Nigeria, we do have certain women who belong to the Catholic religion. And as you might be aware, they don't tend to encourage the use of contraceptives. So women who belong to this religion may not, patronize these contraceptives. But another reason too has been the fear of side effects from these modern contraceptives. Some people feel that if women use contraceptives, it will actually burn up. So I'm using some of the reasons from the surveys that have been undertaken. So burn up women's eggs. It's somehow the contraceptives will burn up all of these eggs, or they can raise a woman's blood pressure to levels that can actually lead to death. In some cases, people think that condoms can, get stuck inside of a woman and then make its way through her body, causing havoc as it goes through. Vasectomy is another way that can be used, but some people also think that vasectomy can render men mentally unstable, right? And the issue with the condom, some people also think that an IUD, women feel as if they use an IUD, it can travel, somehow to her heart or even to her brain, or the metal can rust and lead to health complications. So these are some fears of side effects that people genuinely hold. And then another issue too can be about, affordability. In some cases, women cannot afford these contraceptives and therefore they opt for traditional methods. But then we know that these methods oftentimes are not as effective as the modern methods. And so therefore we see, these issues where women are using these traditional methods but can still become pregnant. And then I think a final issue can also be about supply of these modern methods. Right, so in developed parts of the world, you have a large range of different options that women can opt for. In certain low and middle income countries, these ranges are not like, and in many parts of Nigeria, you don't have so much choice, right? So if you don't have so much choice, perhaps you are not comfortable with using one method. If there was the option to use a different method, perhaps you would sign on to modern contraceptive use. But where the options are not fully available, it can reduce then the uptake of these methods. So I think, when you think about all of these issues that are real challenges to the uptake of contraceptives in Nigeria and many other countries on the continent, I think that there should be, for example, more education, right, on to try to reduce some of the fears related to the use of these contraceptives, this fear of side effects, the IUD moving all the way to your brain and all of that. Perhaps there has to be more education being done on, what these methods are and how they work so that they can diffuse or remove some of these fears. Also, one thing that tends to be done is that when we talk about, these family planning interventions, oftentimes they tend to be targeted at the woman, right? But in Nigeria and in many other African settings, childbirth isn't only a woman's issue, right? You need to be able to bring spouses on board. Sometimes you even have to be able to bring a whole community on board when you are dealing with these issues of family planning. Because as I mentioned, a lot of people have a say in how many children, people like even a woman's mother-in-law, right? Religious leaders, they all have a say. So when you target family planning methods to only women and you expect that it will lead to an uptake in contraceptives, practically on the ground, you may fall short of your objectives because there are other factors working at the same time that have to be brought to the table. Women's partners have to be brought to the table. It has to be explained the benefits of contraceptive use, the benefits of planning one's family, and the community as a whole needs to be brought on board just so that they don't misinterpret a husband's use of contraceptives as him being weak, if you like, or not, maybe you are less of a man because you don't have so many children. These are conversations that need to be had. And once you understand the context, it makes it easier for these family planning interventions to be successful. And then we see the increase in the uptake. And then I think that also with regards to issues of, affordability, issues of supply, we should see wider, more regular, affordable supply of these methods so that women can access them. So these, I don't want to go on for too long, but yes, these are my thoughts on the issue. Some of the issues that, prevent a good uptake of these methods. So as you can see, there are religious, cultural, economic issues at play, but I think that it's not insurmountable. It's possible that we can address these challenges and hopefully see an increase in the uptake of these modern methods.
Well, thank you for this excellent description and illustration of a very complex, sensitive issue. And you've alluded already to the roles of men and women, to the cultural norms that are in place, and to education at the same time. So I was wondering, we've seen in many sub-Saharan countries that I read at the World Economic Forum, that educational gaps between men and women actually narrowing, that they aren't that large anymore. However, at the same time, the labor markets are extremely gendered, so segregated by gender, that women almost always work in low-paid services and informal jobs. So given that there is maybe this increase in labor market skills, how would it be possible? What would be a good way to actually channel female resources, educational resources, into also higher paying jobs, which would also give a lot more autonomy, for instance?
So when we talk about these types of high-paying jobs and why women tend to be underrepresented in these, particularly in parts of the world where I come from, I can take an example of jobs in STEM, for example, right? So that's when we talk about science, technology, engineering, and then math jobs. So that's what we call when we talk about STEM jobs. Now, currently from my readings, women make up only about 28% of the workforce in these STEM jobs, right? And then one reason for this is there seems to be this impression in many parts of the world that, these jobs typically are meant for men, right? Women shouldn't even attempt to enter these types of jobs. They are not cut out for them, they will not excel at them. And so therefore, women will tend to opt for, less prestigious options. So in my part of the world, for example, you see a woman who is in the studying science, for example. You ask her what she wants to be. She might say, "Oh, I want to become a nurse." "Why not a doctor?" "Oh, the men will be the doctors, I'll be a nurse," things like that. And I think that because of this, we are seeing a lot more programs, right, aimed at trying to encourage women to study these supposedly, male-dominated courses. And not just study the courses, but also take up job positions in these areas. I've heard of a program, Women in STEM, which is actually based in the US, if I'm not mistaken. So this is an issue. This tells me that this is an issue not just in the developing world, but perhaps even in the developed world as well. Now, in
Absolutely.
Ghana, where I am from, we also run STEM clinics, right? So what these are meant to do is to try to increase young girls' interests in science, right? And one way that they do this is to try to get these young girls, who are at the, I think, the equivalent of high school in the US, to try to engage more with young female scientists, right? So that they can see people like them functioning in these roles, in these career positions, right? And then they get to learn, the wide range of opportunities that could be offered if they are able to go through with, the study of these STEM subjects. And sometimes they're one of the underlying incentives for these STEM clinics is that, you get to interact with role models, and then it will boost, these young girls' confidence about participating in these STEM related courses so that we can remove these negative perceptions. So I think one way that we can do this is, yes, trying to change our way of thinking. But I also want to take the opportunity to emphasize something else, having listened to your question. It is one thing, you can encourage a woman or a young girl to go in for a study of a STEM subject, right? Or to go in for a study like economics, educate a lady even to the master's or to the PhD level in these, what people might say are male-dominated courses. But it's another thing entirely to expect that all of these young girls who may be highly trained in these areas will go on to take jobs in these high-paying sectors. And why do I say this? Well, because as women, it is known that there are these noted inherent incompatibilities between their market work and also their domestic and care responsibilities, particularly in the developing world. So what we find, what studies have shown, is that sometimes women who may be highly trained would still accept lower paying jobs, part-time jobs, even work in the informal sector, because oftentimes these are characterized with greater flexibility, right? So it would allow them to carry out their domestic and care responsibilities, especially in countries that tend to have more or stronger patriarchal leanings, right? And leave majority of these types of jobs, domestic work and care responsibilities on women's shoulders. So it's two-pronged. If you want women to be engaged in these courses, yes, encourage them. But even after that, there have to be social policies in place to make it possible for the women to actually take advantage of their training and opt for these high-paying, high-productivity jobs. So I'm talking about social policies like, affordable, accessible childcare programs, right? Even domestic technologies that can make it easier to spend less time, carrying out these domestic roles. Things like even adequate maternity leave, things that could be seen to be basic but are still challenges when we come to women actually participating effectively and to their maximum potential in the labor markets.
That's a broad picture, and it's also a very challenging program, a necessary yet challenging program. At this point, I can only say thank you so much for giving this run through all these topics. I'm very glad that you took the time and the effort to give us a little glimpse into this topic.
Thank you very much for having me. It has been a pleasure.